You heard her husband speak today, and so now we're going to hear her side of the story. So now here's Fran.
My name is Fran, and I'm a member of the Worldwide Association of Al-Anon. My home group is Bessemer, Alabama. And I'm there at least once a week, and sometimes twice, and sometimes three times. I go on a regular basis to my home group, and I hope you do too. I must tell you that I feel such love from you this weekend, and I thank you for that. I feel that you are my friends, and I think that's why my butterflies aren't acting up as much as they usually do. I would like to thank Jean and her committee for inviting us this weekend. This has been just the cream of the crop. It's been fantastic. We have loved being with you. There's a huge, beautiful fruit basket in our room when we arrived, and we appreciate that so much. You have been so kind to us, and you have such a beautiful facility here. When we entered the state, it said, "Wild, wonderful West Virginia." Oh, I believe it. I really do. I was in West Virginia many years ago at an education meeting at the Greenbrier, and that's the only time I've ever been in West Virginia.
That's the wild part.
That's the wild part. Now, as I remember it, it was pretty wild. But it's just great to be back, and thank you so much for asking us to be with you. I'm supposed to tell you what it was like and what happened and what I'm trying to be like now. I was the only daughter in the family. I have one brother. And you know, I was brought up in a home that I have found out is just plain dangerous. For an alcoholic or an Al-Anon, I was brought up in a good Christian home. I was taken to church regularly by my parents. My mother was a school teacher, and she worked very hard to bring us up the way she thought we should be brought up. She insisted that we get an education. I know now that they did without things to see that we had the things we needed, including an education. They were hard-working, middle-class people. My mother would give her check to my dad, and he would put it in a joint account. And there was always money for clothes, for all the bills, to have a nice place to stay, and a car, and vacations, and all those nice things. So I grew up having a lot of nice things. We were not wealthy, but I didn't do without anything. My mother, I'm sure Vicki, my mother would have told me tonight if she had been here, stand up straight and speak clearly. She told me a lot of other things too. One of them was, don't date anybody who drinks. That's ironic, isn't it? I didn't for a long time. I tried very hard to be a dutiful daughter and to do the things I should. I worked very hard in school and I made good grades because I knew it was expected of me and because I loved my parents so much that I wanted to please them. I really worked hard to please them. I was dating a boy who went to Auburn University in Alabama, and he gave me his fraternity pin. And then I found out that occasionally he drank a beer, and I gave him back his fraternity pin. I was determined that I was not going to marry anybody who drank. I had never been around alcohol. It was not in our home at all. But I had been warned about it. I grew up in such a sheltered home. You have no idea how sheltered I was. My children laughingly say now about me, "Mom is so naive that she thinks the book about the happy hooker is about a contented lady who makes rugs." That's about the way it was with me. I knew a whole lot about books, but I didn't know very much about life. And I had just been taken care of all my life. When I finished college at the age of 20, I was offered two jobs. One was teaching school. Now, this was in the 40s. One was teaching school, and they offered me $85 a month, which was the going rate for teachers at that time. And the USO was going full steam in Anniston, Alabama, at Fort McClellan, because the war was on. This is World War II, children. And they offered me $150 a month and the use of a car. So you know which job I took. But I was a very sensible young lady, and I thought, now I'm not getting mixed up with any of these boys coming through this fort, because they're on their way to battle. And I don't want to have any part of that. I do not want to have a broken heart. I am just as free as the wind, and there are lots of things I want to do, and I have plenty of time to do it because I'm young and I'm not getting involved with these boys. And then Jim Drysdale came through. And he said to me the first night I met him, "I'm going to marry you." And I thought, what strange fella is this? And I laughed. I didn't know another way to react to it. But it certainly made an impression. And every time he'd come in, he'd say, "Now, what's my name?" And I'd say, "Well, Jim, I know, but that last name is a hard name. I never heard it before, never dreaming it would someday be mine." And every Sunday when he would come in, he would ask me his name. And I finally learned it. And then 6 months later, we were married. My mother cried all day. She said, "You know nothing about him. You've never met a member of his family. He may have two wives somewhere." Which, you know, could have happened. It really could have. But we went right on with our business, you know. Another thing I said was, "I'm not going to have a baby right away. I'll wait till he gets back from overseas." He did not go overseas until we had been married 4 months, and at that time I was pregnant. I didn't even know it when he went overseas, but I found out shortly afterward. Jim was gone between a year and a half and 2 years. He had a very hard time as a soldier. He went to Europe. He was wounded twice. He was taken prisoner by the Germans. He was a German prisoner at the time our little girl was born. I first got a telegram from the government that said, "We regret to inform you that your husband is missing in action." And that's a tough one. And then a few weeks later, I got another one saying, "We regret to inform you that your husband is a prisoner of war." And that was a tough one too. But we made it. We made it through it all. And Jim came back. And while he was gone, I thought, "I bet he'll start smoking while he's overseas." You see, this clean-cut young man neither smoked nor drank, as far as I knew. I had never seen him do either one. And when he came back, he was not smoking. But, oh, was he drinking. And I had no idea what to do about it. We immediately picked up our little girl and our luggage and moved to Buffalo, New York. And we stayed there for about a year and a half. And it was very, very cold. Oh. I never dreamed there was so much snow in the whole world. And the wind, oh, the wind is terrible in Buffalo. It will really blow you down if you don't hold on to ropes. It was rough. Well, I just stood it as long as I could stand it, and I thought, if I stay here the rest of my life, I just can't stand this. And you know, at home, I had been in a little town where we took cookies next door, and we sat on the porch and visited with our neighbors, and we knew everybody in town, and here I didn't know anybody. And and you can't get out in the snow enough to meet anybody, you know. And I could just see myself just with snow all around me the rest of my life. So I just begged Jim, let's go back south. And he said, well, I liked the south when I was there. It's all right with me. If you'll be happier, we'll go. So we did. We had used our GI loan for a house, and we had used all the money we had saved for furniture, and we just sold it all out for nearly nothing just so we could come back south. I think now we would not do that if we hadn't been such young kids. We didn't realize really what we were doing. We didn't either one have a job. We just put our little girl in the car and just left, you know? And we just moved right in with my mother and daddy. They had a big house, and they said, well, just come on, and they fixed part of their house for a little apartment for us on the side, and we had our own little entrance, and we had a little bedroom and bathroom and kitchenette, and we stayed there until we could get an apartment, which was a while, because housing was really difficult at that time. But Jim got a job selling cars. Now, I didn't know about selling cars at that time. I thought that was going to be a good job because everybody wanted a new car since the war was over. So they were just taking cars away from dealers, you know. But that was an alcoholic's paradise. I got a job teaching school, and we worked, and we saved some of our money, and we finally got us a house. We had another child, a little boy, and then we had another child, a little girl. And Jim kept drinking, and the drinking got worse and worse. And I can remember at one time I thought to myself, you know, you're sort of a stick in the mud. You don't know anything about this drinking. Maybe it must be a pretty good thing. He enjoys it so much. I believe I'll find out about it. So we were very close friends with another couple. He and I talked together, and so we decided that we would play cards one night. I told Jim, I said, Jean and I are going to see if we can get drunk and see how it feels. And he said, well, if you're going to do that, I'm not going to take you anywhere acting like that. So we said, okay, we'll just go to our house and get drunk. So we played cards and we drank and we played cards and we drank. And finally, Jean, who has no more experience than I did at it, said, I cannot finish this one. She was looking a little green. And I said, oh, you're a sissy. Give it to me. So I finished mine and I finished hers. And they went home. And I want you to know it hit me. I was the sickest thing you have ever seen in your life. I sat on the floor by the toilet all night. And I can remember looking up at Jim and saying, you do this on purpose? That was my one and only experience with drinking. I never tried it again. We would go to parties and they would give us drinks and I would hide mine behind plants, or I would excuse myself and go in the bathroom and dump it out. You know, just anything to get rid of it, because I was not about to drink it. I knew what it did to me. But I was trying to be a good sport and it didn't work. I was just a bad sport with a weak stomach. It got worse and worse and worse. And it got to the point where Jim sometimes didn't come home till 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. And I wanted to know where he was and what person he was with particularly. And I always imagined a good-looking woman he was with. And I wanted to know how much money he was spending. I wanted to know the whole thing. I was very curious. And so I knew that if I went to bed, that I'd miss my chance. So I set the card table up in the living room, and I would grade papers. And I would think, he'll see me grading papers, and he'll just think I'm working, and he won't know I'm waiting up for him, which was what I thought, but he didn't think that. But I had the best kept papers of any teacher in the school. My papers were always up. So this one night, I was sitting there grading papers. It was about 1 o'clock, and the phone rang. And this gruff voice said, "We got your husband in jail." And I said, "What did he do?" And I thought, in jail? I never have even known anybody who was in jail. And I really was upset. And I thought to myself, I can't let him get off the line until I find out what this is all about. So I said in my sweetest voice, "What has he done? Why do you have him in jail?" And he said, "DWI." And that's what they call DUI now, you know. And I thought, DWI, what is that? I did not know. I could not think of what it was. And I had to know. So I said, "Pardon me, what does that stand for?" I wish you could have heard the sarcasm in his voice as he told me, as if to say, "You can't be married to this drunk and not know." Well, I walked the floor for a while, and then I decided, you know, the denial we go through, I decided he was not really in jail. Somebody had just called me up and told me that, and he was really kidnapped. So I called one of the salesmen Jim worked with, and I told him what had happened. And he said, "Oh, Fran, go on back to bed. He'll be home in the morning." And I said, "Oh, no, I'm not going back to bed. I'm going out to that jail and see." And he said, "Well, you can't go out there in the middle of the night like this." And I said, "Well, I thought maybe you'd come go with me." So he said, "Okay, I'll be there in a few minutes." Well, I checked the children, and they were all three asleep. So I just locked the door when he came and left with him. I hope the neighbors weren't watching. But I didn't think of that at that time at all. So away I went with this fella, and he took me out to the jail in Lipscomb. And the jail was very strange. It had windows on the outside that came all the way down to the ground. And you could walk around on the outside and look in. So it had high weeds in the yard, and they were wet. I came up to my knees. Here I went around the jail, walking around from window to window, peeping in, looking at all the drunks. And after a while, I found him in his shirt and tie, passed out. That was just one of the crazy, crazy things I did. When I finally got to this program, I had no trouble with the insanity part at all. I did so many crazy things along the way because I had a hard time being realistic about what was happening to us. I knew nothing about alcoholism. The only thing that I had ever heard about alcoholism, I had read in a sociology book, and it talked about the Skid Row bums in Chicago. And I had a mental picture of these fellas in old torn undershirts sitting on the curb with their bottles of cheap wine. And that's what I thought an alcoholic was. And I didn't know that you could go to work every day in your suit and your tie and go to church on Sunday and play golf at the country club and be well thought of generally. And and be an alcoholic. I didn't know you could do that. I did not know what an alcoholic was. And so I did not put my husband in that category at all. I didn't know really what was wrong with him. He told me sometimes that it was my fault. And I got where I wondered about it, and I thought if I could be a better housekeeper. So I would scrub, and I would shine, and I had the cleanest house you ever saw. And then I thought, if I looked better, and so I would work really hard on me, trying to look better. Or maybe if I would be a more affectionate wife, so I would buy black negligees, and I would be so sweet. And then the next day, I'd be screaming and yelling my head off. I was very inconsistent in my behavior, and it's no wonder he got drunk. You know, I don't think I caused it. Al-Anon told me I didn't, but I'm sure I was a puzzle to live with because I was trying so many things to get him to stop drinking, anything to get him to stop drinking, and of course it didn't work. We went through some really bad times financially. I would go to my dad time after time and ask him for money, and he never turned me down. He always gave me money, but I could tell that he was worried about me. My mother would say to me, "Why don't you divorce him? You don't have to live like that." And they were the only ones that I would ever talk to about Jim. I taught Sunday school, and I kept it a great secret from all my church friends. I did not want anybody to know what it was really like. And I had no idea that there were any people anywhere that you could talk to about it, because I didn't know there were other people like all of you. I didn't know there were any others. I thought I was the only one. There was no violence in our home. I would have run. I would have been too scared to stay. I would have been too mad to stay. So there was no violence in our home at all. But it was just that it was so heartbreaking. I can remember crying and crying and crying, and of course it never doing any good. But I was so glad that I had a job that I loved, because I could go in that schoolroom and close the door, and I would be in a whole different world, and I wouldn't think about him. And I wouldn't think about the drinking, and I wouldn't think about the debts. I would think about the children. And I was a good school teacher. And I would teach them and love them. And I'm so thankful that I had that to fall back on. I think it kept me out of a lot of trouble. One day, some of the teachers in our school came to me, and they said, "Fran, we're thinking about going back to college and getting some graduate credit. And you have a station wagon. Why don't you come go with us and we'll go in your station wagon?" So I said, "Okay, I think I'd like to do that." So I asked my mom and dad if they would come and sit with the children one night a week. And they said, "Oh, they'd love to." Our children were their only grandchildren. And so one night a week, I would go with six or seven teachers. And we would eat dinner on the way. And we would talk about things that I was interested in hearing about. And there was no drinking. And then we would go to class, and I would learn something that would be important to me. And I just loved it. It was so much fun. It was not that I was so intellectually inclined. It was just that I enjoyed having a night out. And I went on and finished that class and did well. And then I took another class. And then I took another class. And I just kept going to school. And the reason was I just couldn't give that up. And pretty soon I got a master's degree. And they gave me $50 a month raise, which was a lot of money then, a whole lot of money. And I always signed my check and gave it to Jim, because that's what my mother had done. And sometimes there wouldn't be enough money to even pay the bills. And so I decided, I am not giving Jim this $50. I'm going to do something else with it. Now, this is part of my crazy thinking. Instead of taking all my check and putting it in a different bank account, I figured out a way that I could spend this $50. So I went out looking, And I found a beautiful brick ranch house home that at that time cost $50 more than the small. It turned into a very good investment. But that's where my $50 went. But that shows you what crazy thinking I was doing. It was not logical. It was not consistent. It was just what I had to do that day to get through that day, and sometimes that hour. And I look back and I think, how could I have been so stupid? But that was the way my thinking was going. I was getting sicker and sicker and sicker all the time. Somebody told me not long ago, I think you Al-Anons were sicker than you AAs. And I said, absolutely. No doubt about it. He was passed out. He didn't know what was going on. I was the one sitting there sick. And so I was pretty sick. I knew that Jim was having a very hard time, but I didn't realize how bad it was. And one Monday morning, I went into my classroom, and the secretary came to my door, and she said, Fran, get your purse. There has been an accident. Now, I didn't want anybody to know this. I was ashamed of it. But for some time, I had been wishing for an accident. In fact, I had even looked around to see if I could make one in the house. I thought about stringing dental floss down the stairs. And then I thought, you know, he'd just break both legs and I'd have to take care of him. So I gave it up. But in my heart, I had known for some time that he was going to have an accident and maybe he'd get killed. I think my fear was that he would kill somebody else who was innocent. But I had truly been wishing for one, and that was one bill that I saw to it that was paid, and that was the insurance. When this boy left me, I was going to be well fixed. Okay, so you can imagine the guilt that I felt immediately, and I thought, here's this accident. So I said, it was an automobile accident, wasn't it? And she said, no, Fran. She said, Jim was cleaning his gun, and it went off. And I knew immediately this was not true. We had never had a gun in the house. Jim did not own a gun. So I knew that he had tried to kill himself. One of the teachers took me to the hospital, and for about 10 days, we did not know if he would make it or not. He was not trying to scare me. He was not bluffing. He meant to kill himself. He had aimed that gun at his heart, and he had missed by a fraction of an inch. He was a big man in those days, and the doctor said that the layers of fat stopped the bullet short of his heart. As soon as I realized what had happened, I spent a lot of time on my knees in that chapel praying that he would make it. I knew that I didn't want him dead. And slowly, slowly, he got better. And finally, they let him go home. And he talked to me. We hadn't done much talking for a long time. Communication had just gotten worse and worse and worse. And he said, Fran, I know that alcohol is at the base of my trouble. And I promised God, and I want to promise you, that I am not going to ever take another drink. And you know, I believed him. I believed him because I knew that you had to be really serious about doing something about your life if you were willing to die for it. And I didn't know about alcohol. I didn't know that he would want to not take another drink and not be able to without help. I did not know this. In fact, when we'd go out to dinner, I'd say, just take two drinks. I'd give him the first two drinks. Because I thought anybody can have two drinks and just keep going, you know. And I thought that I was doing the right thing. I thought so many things I did were the right thing. And I found out after I came to Al-Anon that almost everything I was doing was wrong. And, you know, like I would pay his bills. I would pick up his bad checks. I would do anything to protect the family. I thought I was doing the right thing, but I just didn't know the difference. Well, all that summer, Jim didn't drink. That was in April. And all during May and June, he did not drink. But he would sit in our den, and he would look out over the garden, and he would just stare. And he would not smile. And I would think, good heavens, is he going to be like this the rest of his life? I've never seen anybody so unhappy in my life. I almost wish he were drinking again. Until it happened. And he went out to the ball game this night. And he called me, and I could tell on the telephone, you know how we can tell on the telephone, that he was drinking. And I was fit to be tied by the time he got home. I had walked the floor, and I had gotten in such a state because my thoughts were, I cannot start through this again. I can't do it. I can't hold up under it. I'll go crazy. I can't do it. I have these three children to look after. I can't live like this anymore. Now, I love this man. I really did. But I decided that night when I was walking the floor that I had to get a divorce, that I had no choice. But I didn't tell him that. The next morning when I got up, it was summertime. It was July. And I got dressed to go to see my lawyer. And Jim knew it. And he begged me to wait. He said, will you wait and let me try one more thing? And I said, what else is there to try? And he said, well, my doctor told me about this fellow who had been sober for 2 years in a group called AA. And he said, I don't know if it'll help me or not. I said, well, why didn't you already try it? And he said, well, I really didn't think that a group could do anything to help me. And I said, well, go ahead and try it. I'll wait. Because I really deep down didn't want a divorce. I wanted him to quit drinking. And this was one more chance. Club that night, and he came back with a handful of literature, and we sat cross-legged in the bed and read it out loud to each other. And I said to him, I like the way it sounds. Can I go too? And he said, oh no, they don't allow women down there. I tell you what, he had lied to me so much that I listened for these things, you know. I was getting sharp. So I said, what about this Ada and this Peggy you mentioned? And he said, oh, Ada keeps the books and Peggy does the dishes. He told me later that he didn't know if it was going to work or not, and he didn't want me to go and be disappointed. But about 6 weeks later, he told me, sat down and told me that I could go. There were very few people in the Bessemer Club at that time. This was on July the 11th, 1961, when Jim went, and I went, I guess, the end of August in 61. We did not have Al-Anon in Bessemer at that time. Al-Anon was fairly new in the South, and so I went to open AA meetings, and I just loved the people. They were so kind to me and so dear, and they wanted Jim to be sober so much. And somebody would show up at our house every single night and take him somewhere. And I thought, I don't even see him as much as I used to. But at least he came home sober. But I was sharp. I watched this carefully. I expected it to end. So every time he'd come home, I would go up to him and hug him and kiss him and sniff him. He called me his sniffer kisser. And he got a little bit resentful about it. But they told him, they said, Jim, it took you 17 years to get her this sick. Give her a little bit of time. And I'm glad that they did that. Jim caught on to the program. He loved it. He was on this big pink cloud. The only thing that really bothered me was that every Sunday afternoon we would go to the home of one of the salesmen, and he would read to him out of the big book. He was trying so hard to get the whole world sober. And finally, some of the older members in AA grabbed his coattail and said, "Jim, we don't do it that way." And I was so thankful when they did, because I could just tell how they hated to see us coming on Sunday afternoon. But we traveled around Alabama and Mississippi, and we had a going bunch at the Bessemer Club. We would meet together and go, and we just had a good time. We went to Mississippi, we went to Georgia, we went up into southern Tennessee, and we went to Florida, and we went all over Alabama. And we had a grand time, and we met a lot of good friends and people I'll never forget, because they all tried to help us so much. After Jim had been sober 7.5 years, he was made president of a small company, and he started to travel one night a week. And after about 6 months, he came in and he said, "Fran, I need to talk to you. I've been drinking on the road for the last few months, and I just can't keep it from you any longer." And I had no idea. Not once did I have the slightest hint of it. And it was just like the whole world opened up and I fell in. We had gotten Al-Anon in Bessemer in late 61, and I didn't really think that I needed this, whatever it was, because there really wasn't anything wrong with me. If he would quit drinking and he had quit drinking, our life would be beautiful, and I didn't really know how crazy and how sick I was. But I went out of curiosity more than anything else, and I liked what I heard. And I went to meetings, and I took the steps intellectually in a few hours. I did what I thought you had to do to be a good Al-Anon, but I did not get the program in my soul. And when Jim started to drink again, I did not have enough Al-Anon to see me through. I got sicker than anybody. I absolutely pulled away from the world. I went back in my cocoon. I would go to school. I would come home. I would go to the grocery store. I quit going to church. I quit going to Al-Anon for a while. I would see friends, and I would cross the street so I wouldn't have to talk to them. It was a terrible, terrible time. I had never been like that in my life before, but I did not want anybody to talk to me. All I could think of was this beautiful life that we had was gone. Jim continued to drink, and as much as I would try to talk to him, nothing did any good. And of course, I didn't know the right things to say to him. I didn't know how to help, really. Everything I was doing was just making it worse. And I kept in close contact with two friends who were both in AA. And I stopped by their house one afternoon, and I was fussing and complaining because Jim was drinking, and I said, "He knows where he can get help. Why doesn't he go?" And you know, the same thing was true for me. I knew where I could get help, and I was not going. And the man who was Jim R. said to me, "Fran, you need to go back to Al-Anon." And I got in my car, and I started home, and I thought of what Jim had said, and I thought, he's right. They're the only people who understand and can help me. Maybe I can really learn something now. And that Thursday night, I went back to our group, and it had grown. It was flourishing. They had so many new members. They had hardbacks. They had all kind of pamphlets. They had literature that they didn't have when I was there. They had so many things that were helpful, and they were glad to see me again. And I sat down on the front row, and for a year, I did not miss a meeting. And I sat there, and I listened, and I did not say anything. And I read everything there was to read. And I got a sponsor who was a tough girl. She's been up here. Her name is Mickey. Some of you may remember Mickey. And she put me through the steps in a different way. And it took me months to get through. But this time, it was a different business entirely. I was the one who was sick, and I knew it. Jim might drink the rest of his life. That was up to him. I hoped he wouldn't. I knew how unhappy he was drinking, And I hoped for his sake that he would find serenity and sobriety. But there was not anything right then I could do about it. I was too busy getting Fran better. And I did what I had to do for me. And Jim would not say to me, I don't want you to go to Al-Anon. He knew better than that. But he would invite me somewhere special every Thursday. I'll take you out to dinner at your favorite place tonight. Or let's go to that movie tonight that you've been wanting to see. He would ask me somewhere that he knew I really wanted to see or go. And I never went with him. I would say, no, this is my Al-Anon night. I have to go to Al-Anon. And I did that because I knew that this was my one chance to get better again. I started going back to church at the same time I started going back to Al-Anon because I needed both. Our children started going to Alateen, and they needed to go. Alcohol had affected them even more than we thought it had, and they loved Alateen, and they went regularly, and Jim kept drinking and kept being so miserable. And I learned a good many things from the Al-Anons. They told me that I had some choices. Now, you know, most sane people know they have some choices. But I just kept going the crazy old same way, day after day after day, until Al-Anons would say to me, hey, you need to think about this. You have some choices. You know, you don't have to give him your check every month. And that's when I opened my bank account. And I started saving some money. I lost weight. I bought some new clothes. I started taking art lessons. I went to Europe. Left him at home. I think that jarred him a little. He really didn't believe I'd go off at that and leave him like that, because I never had before. But I really wanted to see all those things over there that I had taught about. I really needed to see those things firsthand. And I enjoyed it, and I really went 3 times in all. But the last time I went, when I came back, he had papered the bathrooms with 1 million butterflies. And I thought then, what's going on? He knows that this is a kind of a personal symbol with Al-Anons, even though it's not official, that we come from something really bad, like a cocoon, like a worm, and that we become better, like a butterfly. And so I knew that he was thinking of me and thinking of this when he did this for me. And I thought that was very nice. And that week I went by Katie and Jim's again, these good friends of ours. And my attitude was different. I was not complaining and griping anymore. I was telling them the good things that were happening to me. And when I started to leave, Jim said, Fran, why don't you tell Big Jim that we're having a meeting on the 10th step tonight and he ought to be there. And I said, sure, Jim, I'll tell him. And I left, and on the way home, I thought, nah, I'm not going to tell him. I can just see him now. He'll just shrug his shoulders and walk away. He won't go. So I went on in the house, and I started cooking supper. And I heard his key in the lock. And I just flew to the door. And I told him what Jim had said. And sure enough, he shrugged his shoulders, and he walked back to the bedroom. Didn't say a word. And I thought, no, now he's not going to rain on my parade. That's all right. I knew he was going to do that. He's not going to upset me. So I went on in, and I was just stirring the food, maybe a little harder than usual. But I was just stirring, you know. And he came in, and he had on a clean shirt. And I said, oh, are you going somewhere? Where are you going? And he said, I'm going to AA, and don't you cry. Oh, I had been hoping so much he would go back to AA for his own sake. And I was so happy, and I did cry. I'm a crier. It's a wonder I haven't cried yet. But I did cry, and the children were all grown, and I called each one and told them that their daddy had gone back to AA. And they were so happy. They loved their dad. And they wanted him, they wanted the best for him, and they knew that it was to be sober. It was just like a dream come true. It was so terrific to have Jim sober again. And he hadn't had a drink since that time, and that was over 11 years ago. He works his program very seriously, and I work mine very seriously, because it means life and death to us. It means everything to us. I had been teaching school a long time, and my principal told me finally, "Hey, this is your 30th year to teach school. You can retire after this year if you want to." So I checked on the money, and it was really good. So I thought, I'd be crazy to keep teaching when I just wouldn't be making much more than that if I was working. So I just quit. You know, I'd retired. And I cleaned my house, and I did all the things I needed to do, and it was about a week later, and there I sat. And I thought, hey, you know, I was in my 50s, early 50s, and I thought, am I just going to sit here the rest of my life and watch soap operas and clean house and cook and go to meetings? And I want to do something more, I think. And then I thought, you know, you have learned in Al-Anon that there is a God of your understanding that you can talk to about these things. And God had become different to me in Al-Anon. I had always believed in God. I had always gone to church and Sunday school. But now, he had become my friend. I could sit down and meditate and read my literature and pray and ask God to guide me. And he did. And so I thought, let's see if you walk like you talk. So that morning when I had my meditation, I said to God, "Here I am. I don't know what I'm going to do with the rest of my life. But if there is something out there that you would like for me to do, please let me know." And at the end of it, I said, "Oh, by the way, God, you better hit me with it a little bit hard. You know, I don't always pay attention." And that Thursday, I was at the beauty parlor, and I was sitting under the dryer, and I was not thinking about God at all. I was reading a magazine, and a lady came up to me and knocked on my dryer and lifted it up and said, "Do you have a master's in administration?" And you know, nobody had ever asked me that before. And I had to think, what is that thing in? And I said, "Yes, I do." And she said, "You're the one we've been praying for." And that was a clue to me. It was. And I thought, oh, good heavens, I hope I'm not going to be sent to India as a missionary. But I had asked God for this, and so I had to follow through, and I said, "What do you have in mind?" And she said, "We would like for you to be the principal at our parochial school." And you know, we ask God for these things, and then we kick and scream all the way, don't we? And I said, "I can't do that. I'm not Catholic. I don't know anything about Catholic." And she said, "Well, will you come talk to the priest?" And I said, "Yes, I'll do that." So my son came over that night, and he said, "Mom, I think you'd enjoy that." And I said, "Oh, I don't know. You know, I don't know what they would expect of me. I don't know if I can do that." And he said, "Well, go on and talk to the priest." So I did. The next day I went, and this big, fat priest was there, rough voice. And he said, "Young lady, I understand that you're not coming to us as principal because you're Methodist." And I said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "Now, if you were Baptist, I could understand it." He said, "Methodist is okay. You can do what you're supposed to do here. I want you to run the school. I don't want you to teach religion." And I said, yes, sir, I can run the school. So I started running the school, and I have just finished my 9th year as principal. We have children from four years old in kindergarten through 8th grade. Now, I had always taught high school, and this is fantastic. We used to have problems with unmarried girls who were having babies, alcohol, drugs. Sometimes we'd get our tires cut if they didn't like the grades we gave them. It was rough. And here, our biggest problem is chewing gum. And God and I are working that out very well. I'll tell you, it took me about a year to learn to speak Catholic. But I found out we were very much alike. I believe just about the same things they believe. They were a little more symbolic than we were, but that was fine with me. I had no problems with it at all, and they accepted me, and I appreciated that. We run a tight school, and it's a very, very good school. It's one of two accredited schools in our city, and we are a state-accredited school, and our grades are very high. Our A's start at 93, our B's start at 85. It's rough. They know it, and they know that it's expected of them to do their best. I have fantastic teachers. Half of them have master's degrees. They really love the children. They must love the children in order to teach in that school. And they try very hard to help the children, even after school if necessary. Sometimes when the bell rings and the little ones get out 10 minutes early, I'll sit on the bottom step going upstairs, and they'll come by one after another and give me a hug. Oh, I love those kids. And they'll make valentines for me, you know, and draw hearts and write little love notes. And sometimes they bring a little handful of weeds in to me. It has just been a total joy. And I have to give God the credit for that. I didn't even know they needed a principal. I certainly would not have looked for it. And I am so grateful for that. We have had wonderful things happen to us. When you put it in God's hands, wonderful things happen. Because he wants better things for us than we even want for ourselves. And I was so afraid to do that for so long. But it has been fantastic. We have had some real, real traumatic, sorrowful, terrible things happen in our lives. But we have been able to handle it because of you, because of your love, because of your caring, because you were there with us when we needed you so. I learned a little bit about the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. And I had to accept some things I could not change. And I wouldn't have known to do that if I had not had Al-Anon. When we lost our granddaughter, she was our first grandchild, and she was so bright, and she was so full of life, and she was 17. And it was like the end of the world. And her mother was having a very, very hard time with it, and she would call me, or she would write to me, and she would say, Mother, you keep telling me it will get better, but it gets worse every day. Every day it gets worse. And we would tell her different things to do. We would try to spend time with her. We didn't realize that she was as sick as she was. And she was just simply unable to face life. I wish that she had had some more of this program and could have turned it over to God the way we did. But she killed herself. And this was very, very hard for us. But we got through that too. We know that God is not going to give us more than we are able to handle. We know that he loves us every day. He keeps molding us, sanding us down, and maybe someday we will be the people he wants us to be.
with your help. We learned a little bit about tough love when my son was having problem with social drinking, whatever that is, and his dad was frantically trying to help him. His wife, who is a school teacher, came to me. Her parents were both dead, and she's an only child, and she said, "I have to talk to you about Jimmy," and she told me what was happening, and she said, "Sometimes he doesn't come home till maybe even 1 o'clock. And I knew what she meant. And she said, "You know what I think I'm going to do? I think I'm going to change all the locks on the house and put him out." And I said, "You do that." "That's what you need to do." Well, Jim nearly died. That afternoon, Jimmy came by the house and he said, "Mother, what's going on?" And I said, "Ann's going to change all the locks on the house. And you're going to lose, Ann." He said, "Oh, Mother, it's not that serious." And I started to cry and I said, "Yes, it is. It's that serious." And he called somebody and went to AA that night, and he hadn't had a drink since. And I thank God for that, because he won't have to go through those years that we had to go through. Isn't it wonderful that younger and younger and younger people are coming into the program? It's so fantastic to see all you young people here, that you have a chance for a really wonderful life. I thank you so much for listening to me so patiently and for having me here. I love you very much, and I wish you a wild and wonderful West Virginia year. Thank you.